From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In Brian Kellogg's book about the film critic Pauline Kael, he describes her relationship with movies as tumultuous and possessive, like a volatile love affair. And that love, he says, was nothing short of life-giving. He describes Kael as the ideal audience member. She loved to be entertained, certainly on the screen, but not just there. Kellogg tells the story of Kael's visit to a friend's house where they had gathered in the backyard. A bunch of young kids were running around, and so Kael sat back and said, "I can't wait to see how this comes out." Today in the program, Brian Kellogg is joining us to talk about Pauline Kael, her point of view that was shaped by her upbringing in the West, her vernacular and confrontational style, her 2 decades at The New Yorker that made her the most influential and provocative critic in America. A Life in the Dark, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In Brian Kellogg's book about the film critic Pauline Kael, he describes her relationship with movies as tumultuous and possessive. He says it's like a volatile love affair. That love, he says, was nothing short of life-giving. Today in the program, Brian Kellogg is joining us to talk about his book, Pauline Kael, A Life in the Dark. We'll talk about her point of view that was shaped by her upbringing in the West. We'll talk about her vernacular and confrontational style, her 2 decades at The New Yorker that made her the most influential and provocative critic in America. Brian Kellogg is the author of several biographies, including one of Ethel Merman, and he's also the features editor of Opera News Magazine. And he's joining us today from the studios of NPR in New York City. Brian Kellogg, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I guess we'll start with the most obvious question, and that is your own attraction to Pauline Kael. You've said, and this seems remarkable, Brian Kellogg, but you said you've started reading her reviews in the 7th grade.
Yes, I did. I was a very strange child. I did start reading her in the 7th grade. I remember vividly the day that I went to the library and checked out a copy of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. And I grew up in just outside of Tillamook, Oregon, not even in Tillamook, Oregon, really, which is a small town itself, only about 4,000 people. And we had very little access to movies except what we saw on television. We did have a movie theater in the town of Tillamook, but it took an awfully, awfully long time for movies to get there back in the 60s and 70s. Because they had a first run in the big cities that is much longer than the ones that they have now.
Yeah.
And so it would take 2 years for a movie to get to our local theater.
I mean,
by which it was very old news.
Yeah.
And I can still remember as a kid, you know, every year they would say, "Coming soon, Mary Poppins."
Right.
And it never came.
Right.
And I didn't really mind that much because I didn't really like Julie Andrews even as a child. But that's, you know, I started reading Pauline in the local library and just came under the spell of her prose, basically. I just felt that this person was speaking directly to me.
But wait, what does that mean? I mean, what exactly were you hearing? And was it the style that seemed accessible, you know, because she did write in this vernacular, or was it what she was trying to express, or was it a combination of all of those things?
Well, I think I had already read, I was very much under the spell of movies by an early age, and I did read reviews of movies even as a kid, and a lot of them, the reviews that I read, struck me as being, you know, a little stuffy and a little, I don't know, they didn't speak to me very much. Judith Criss did very much in TV Guide every week. She had a very, very warm and direct style, I thought. And she seemed funny, as Pauline did. Pauline just struck me with her wit immediately. And no, I just felt it was a very sharp, funny, observant tone that was being pitched right to me, and her sensibility really did help shape mine in so many ways. I can see that now when I look back. I was so influenced by this voice kind of, you know, telling me what she liked and what she didn't like that I sort of followed down that path to a great extent myself. So you know, it was all very interesting from that standpoint when I sat down to write the biography.
Yeah. There's this great story that you tell in the introduction of the book that seems to really express, I think, something essential about Pauline Kael's approach to a movie. I mean, she'd gone to speak on this campus of Oregon State University in Corvallis. And,
right.
And she took questions from the audience. And one person asked her this, how many times she saw a movie before she wrote about it. And Pauline Kael said only once. Which, in of itself, that's intriguing. And I want to ask you about that. Is that really true? Did she really only want to see it once? And why was that? But then one of the faculty members said, well, what about Persona? This was the Bergman film.
Right.
And the person, you know, the faculty person who was asking the question said, you know, what about that? Because I had to see it three times before I had any real grasp of it at all. And she says, and I can't tell if this was just snotty or what it was. She says, well, that's the difference between us, isn't it? Well, what does that reveal about Pauline Kael, do you think?
Well, she could be very sharp.
Yeah.
And she, one thing it reveals, I can tell you, she was not terribly sympathetic toward the academic community in general.
Yeah.
She didn't like it. She didn't trust it. And going and giving lectures on campus was very much a part of her life. It was an income generator, among other things. And it was a good way to promote her books, of course. And she had a great rapport with young people, and I think she liked very much the interaction with the students. She always wanted to find out what they were going to see and what they thought of it. That was very, very interesting to her always. But she didn't like the professors terribly well themselves. Mm. She felt that they were jealous of her. She felt that they were resentful of her coming in from the outside and then being able to leave again the next day to go to the next stop. And she just didn't like a lot of what she felt they stood for in terms of film theory and the way they wrote about film, the way they taught film. Mm. It was all a little too high-minded for her. Because she really did have a very, very populist approach.
Yeah. The other part of that story, we can't quite say it all on the radio. There's a, but will you tell it, clean it up for us a little bit?
Oh, well, let's see if I can. Well, what happened was, it was very, very funny. She was lecturing at Mitchell Playhouse at Oregon State University, and someone in the audience in the question and answer session after her lecture asked her if she ever changed her mind about a movie, and she said no. And the fellow pressed the issue, and she said, well, obviously you have something in mind, so what is it? And he said, well, I was thinking of Louis Malle's Murmur of the Heart, which I just saw again not too long ago, and I was wondering if you still thought it was so wonderful, because I found it very sentimental. Hmm. And she looked at him for a very long time. There was this just horrible silence. And she said, well, I'd like to ask you a question. Do you remember your first blank?
Bleep. Sexual encounter.
Yes,
right?
Sexual encounter, yeah. Yes. And the man turned bright red because in 1976 in Corvallis, Oregon, you didn't say this kind of thing in public.
Yeah.
And he said, well, yes, of course I do. And she said, well, honey, just wait 30 years. And it was so telling about her, because she was a crowd pleaser. Mm. She was a performer.
Yeah.
And I always thought that she performed on the page instead of on a stage. Those reviews are really great turns, many of them. As beautifully structured and as persuasively argued as they are, they're also really red hot performances. The last thing she wanted to do was bore the reader. And I don't think she ever did.
Yeah. Her parents, Isaac and Judith Kael, moved to Petaluma, California, 1912, mm-hmm. and they wanted to be part of a Jewish community there, though they weren't drawn to the place by religious feelings. I mean, they were decidedly secular Jews, but they wanted to live among their own people, and they end up on this small farm on the outskirts of town. It was a chicken ranch, and you talk about Petaluma as being this fertile ground for Pauline Kael, any child really interested in reading, you say, and ideas and mm-hmm. and writing. What was it about that place that that nurtured someone like Pauline Kael?
Well, partly it had, I think, to do with the fact that the Jewish community in general has always been very absorbed in culture. Mm. They've always been great readers, great learners, very interested in music and the arts. This has always been a part of the Jewish experience in a broad sense, I think. And there was a lot of that there. There was a lot of reading. There was a lot of discussion of culture and what was going on in the world. And I think it was a pretty lively atmosphere. Her father, Isaac Kael, was one of the founding fathers of the Jewish Community Center in Petaluma, and that booked lecturers and speakers and performers from all over. There was still a very, very active community lecture circuit at that time. And I think it was a pretty lucky place, really, for her to grow up. She also always spoke about the fact that she was the youngest in the family and what you inherited from the older kids, what they passed down to you and what you were able to observe about them. And I know that's true. I mean, I'm the youngest in my family, and that's certainly true. I got an enormous amount from my brother and my cousins.
Do we know what she wanted for herself? How did she conceive of her life in those days? She was bright. She was quite good at the violin. She was a member of the debating club. She was precocious, taken by great, great literature, it seems. And I guess she wanted to write, but do we know anything beyond that?
Yes, and she, when she was in school, she debated Carol Channing.
Wow.
Wouldn't you like to have a tape of that one? I interviewed Carol Channing for the book, and she couldn't for the life of her remember what the subject was that they had, but she did remember it.
What? She did remember it?
Yeah, she did, yeah. Pauline wanted to be a writer. She definitely wanted to write from an early age. She was a voracious reader, devoured books like crazy, and by the time she got to Berkeley, her mind was very much set on one day doing something in writing. Initially, she wanted to do dramatic writing, and she was very interested in playwriting, and she wrote a lot of early efforts, radio scripts and plays and things like this. She wrote a couple of movie treatments, none of which really went anywhere. They were not, by her own later admission, terribly good. And she was, you can see her when you go back and look at these manuscripts, which are all in her archive. You can see her struggling to find her voice, and it just isn't quite gelling. And in fact, it didn't gel until she turned to movie criticism, and that's where she found it.
You write something that in the book I wanted to explore. You say that Pauline Kael seemed intensely proud of the fact that she came from the American West.
Mm-hmm.
You say that she sort of took pains to sort of portray herself as a rebel, this plain-speaking thinker, with disdain for the literary establishment of the East Coast, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
Is it true, or was this just an image that she created for herself? I mean, what was the influence of the West?
I think that's just absolutely who she was.
Yeah.
I think that she came from the West Coast, and she did not really have access to the traditional path to literary success in New York. She was up against, she made her first run at New York in the 1940s. She came to the city in early 1942 and stayed for about 4 years during the war years, and really just didn't get her plane off the ground to speak of at all. She was already very resentful of the people she was up against, the sort of people who had gone to the right prep schools in the East and the right Ivy League schools, and who had much better hopes and chances of getting a job with a Tony literary magazine, such as The New Yorker, where she eventually went to work many years later, or The Atlantic, or whatever that would be. And she, you can see it in her letters to her best friend, Violet Rosenberg, that she wrote at the time in the 1940s. She's very angry about the sense of competitiveness. She feels shut out from many, many opportunities in New York. And I think she carried a lot of that with her over the years. But she also was very strong and very determined. Mm. And eventually she got there. It was just about 20 years after she made the first stab at it.
Pauline Kael loved the film actress Barbara Stanwyck, called her this amazing vernacular actress. And you say that observation was really important in understanding what would make Pauline Kael famous. And yet, as you put in the book, deeply controversial as well, that she liked plain American speech. That seemed to be the way you could describe her style.
Absolutely. Yeah, she did. She liked a lot of different kinds of things. And it wasn't that she was against anything highbrow on principle. It wasn't that at all.
No.
I mean, she loved things like Orson Welles's Shakespeare treatment, Chimes at Midnight, and his Othello. She was, because she thought that they kind of reinvigorated the plays themselves by the cinematic approach that they took. It wasn't that she was against anything highbrow, but she did have a deep connection to things like American screwball comedy. She loved those films of the 1930s with their bite and their wit and their toughness. She was much more attuned in general to the films of the 30s than she was to the more romantic and sentimental films of the 1940s and the World War II years, you know, because they were so burdened down with World War II sentiment and patriotism, and she really had no use for that at all. She hated Mrs. Miniver, hated it with a passion. You know, when I was working on the book, I thought, I looked at every single movie that I wrote about again. It was one of the things that made writing this book very labor-intensive. And I even looked at Mrs. Miniver again. I hadn't seen it for a long, long time. And I think she was right. I mean, I think it's very hard to take now, even though there's a couple of good performances in it. But she did love the tough side of films from a very early age. She loved W.C. Fields and Mae West and Betty Davis and Barbara Stanwyck and the Ritz brothers. She liked the Ritz brothers more than she liked the Marx brothers.
Yeah.
But she loved Cary Grant, you know. She loved his elegance and his class and she loved
Katharine Hepburn, although there's a review she did for the 1968 film The Lion in Winter. This was James Goldman's film, where she could be disappointed by people. She had loved Hepburn forever, and I want to play an excerpt of a review she did for The Lion in Winter. It's performed for us by the actor Ann Decker. Any way to set this up? Anything to say about this?
Well, I think this is a I'm glad you're choosing this, because I think this is a fascinating look at how perceptive she could be about what was going on with an actor. And Katharine Hepburn by this time had ascended to almost sainthood.
Yeah.
In the view of the American public, Spencer Tracy had died, and the story of this great love affair had been put out to the public, which, you know, we now know is probably not really the case. It was really just a different kind of friendship. It now appears, anyway.
Yeah.
But she felt that the public's adoration of Hepburn and the way they had come to feel about her as this kind of great American heroine had crept into her acting technique, and that it was coming out in films like The Lion in Winter. And I think this is what this excerpt shows.
When an actress has been a star for a long time, we know too much about her. For years, we have been hearing about her romances or heartbreaks or whatever the case may be. And all this carries into her presence on the screen. And if she uses this in a role, she's sunk. When actresses begin to use our knowledge about them and how young and beautiful they used to be, when they offer themselves up as ruins of their former selves, they may get praise and awards, and generally do, but it's not really for their acting. It's for capitulating and giving the public what it wants, a chance to see how the mighty have fallen. When Hepburn, the most regal of them all, contemplates her blotches and wrinkles with tears in her anxious eyes, it's self-exploitation, and it's horrible.
She's great.
Yeah, it is great. It is terrific. And, of course, she turned out to be in that line about the awards. She turned out to be quite prescient because Katharine Hepburn did win the Academy Award for The Lion in Winter.
Yeah.
She liked actors to retain the hold that they had had on the public early on.
Right.
She didn't like to see them go soft in any way and trade on public sentiment for them. She just hated that kind of thing. And she felt that Katharine Hepburn and Betty Davis, having been, in her view, you know, two of the very toughest of the early talkies heroines, had an even greater responsibility in that line. And she loved Betty Davis's performance in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane because she thought it was a wonderful parody of Betty Davis's screaming
right.
image, and that she hadn't gone soft at all, which she certainly didn't.
But it's funny. It seems like for Pauline Kael, those initial impulses from an actor or from an audience member receiving that film, they were really critical.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I think so. Absolutely. She was very attuned to the audience always. And when she began writing film criticism, she often would quote something that she might have overheard in the audience at the movie theater. She would mention things that friends of hers who might have gone to the film with her had said to her. She was very much interested in it as a communal experience, really. Mm. And I think she thought that the audience was not listened to a great deal of time by the producers in Hollywood, and that producers and writers grossly underestimated what audiences were capable of accepting. And that's why when films really began to change in the late 60s and all through the 70s, she was so exhilarated by this because she thought that the great dialogue, as she called it, between the screen and the audience had finally begun. And it was a thrilling time for her. When I was working on the book, I actually got very overcome by emotion a few times when I was reading her reviews during that period. And the sense of how thrilled she is by everything that's happening, by everything that's going on in the country, this kind of general atmosphere of unrest and protest and change, and how it's feeding into the films that are coming out of Hollywood. It's so touching, I think, the way how excited she is by it and how thrilled she is.
We need to get to a break, but let me play one more thing. This is from kind of a manifesto that she wrote for Harper's Magazine. This was in 1968. I think it was 1968. The Future of Movies, is that? Did I get that right?
Oh, Trash Art in the Movies.
Trash Art in the Movies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No. I'm thinking of The Future of Movies. That's another thing.
Okay.
This is something that she writes about the audience. Which I think is important. Let me play this. This is another excerpt from something written by the critic, Pauline Kael.
Perhaps no work of art is possible without belief in the audience, the kind of belief that has nothing to do with facts and figures about what people actually buy or enjoy, but comes out of the individual artist's absolute conviction that only the best he can do is fit to be offered to others. An artist's sense of honor is founded on the honor due others. Honor in the arts, and in show business too, is giving of one's utmost, even if the audience does not appear to know the difference, even if the audience shows every sign of preferring something easy, cheap, and synthetic. The audience one must believe in is the great audience. The audience one was part of as a child, when one first began to respond to great work. The audience one is still part of.
It's Pauline Kael. Brian Kello is with us. He's the author of the book Pauline Kael, A Life in the Dark. We need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Brian Kellow. We're talking about his book, Pauline Kael, A Life in the Dark. He's joining us, by the way, from the studios of NPR in New York City. Brian Kellow, let me ask you about how it is that Pauline Kael worked. A friend of hers mentioned, and you make note of this in the book, that she was always taking notes throughout the film, with the stubby pencil always moving. I guess she wrote by hand her reviews as well. Mm-hmm. I even read something that I think it was Vincent Canby had said that you could hear her sighing loudly and cracking wise.
Oh, yeah.
What was it like? Did she always go with an audience? And was it impossible to sit next to her if she was reviewing a film?
Well, when she went to screenings of movies in private screening rooms, she often took a friend or more than one friend. And I don't think those people were bothered by it at all, most of them, because they were used to her. But she was very audible about her reactions to the movies. And she would gasp or sigh or talk back to the screen sometimes. And whether she liked it or didn't like it. And it was maddening to a lot of her critic colleagues because she was distracting them from what they were doing, for one thing. And also, they didn't want to be influenced by her opinion.
Yeah.
They wanted to receive this themselves. And a lot of the film companies, too, the studios, were very annoyed because they felt that she did unduly influence people by talking out loud. In the 60s, she had gone to a screening of Madame X with Lana Turner, which was produced by Universal and distributed by Universal. And she hooted and hollered and laughed and made comments all the way. I mean, it's a terrible movie, no question about it. But all through the film, and Universal wound up dropping her from their screening list, which meant that she simply went out and saw things, Universal films in the theater. And that was really her preferred way to do it anyway for many, many years, because she wanted to test the audience reaction. She wanted to get a sense of how people were reacting to what they were seeing up there on the screen. So I think in a lot of ways she preferred that to sitting in a screening room alone. But she was vocal.
Yeah. Talk about her relationship with the editor of The New Yorker for so many years, William Shawn.
Right.
I guess they couldn't have been more different people in some ways.
Well, they were very strange bedfellows, absolutely. Pauline was direct and very Western and outspoken and wasn't afraid of using rough language and liked to drink whiskey and chain smoked. And William Shawn was a very courtly, old school gentleman. He went to great pains to treat everyone in a very courtly and gentlemanly manner, whether or not it was sincere.
Right.
That was how he, and I don't think it was.
Yeah.
That was how he proceeded with his job. That was part of his idea of professionalism. And I mean, he was not only a highly respected editor, he was a very personally beloved editor by so many of the people who worked at The New Yorker for so many years. But Pauline just couldn't quite figure him out, and he couldn't figure her out. There was one wonderful story that I don't think I wound up putting in the book that someone told me. There was some shuffling of offices going on at The New Yorker at one point, and Pauline was just temporarily moved into the cubicle of this woman who was a very straight-laced, soft-spoken type of person. And Sean and one of the other editors sort of came into the room and heard this just outburst of profanity and foul language on the telephone coming from the other side of this cubicle. And they were horrified to think that this soft-spoken lady would be talking like this. And, of course, it turned out to be Pauline, which didn't surprise anybody. but she thought he was a great editor. It's not that she didn't respect him. That has been written by other people, and that is absolutely not true. She had enormous regard for him, and I think even a little bit of affection for him.
Yeah.
And she certainly was very grateful to have that audience and that berth at The New Yorker during such an exciting time for movies. And they didn't cut her, you know. They didn't. Sean was great. He didn't. He didn't say, okay, 1,500 words.
Yeah.
On my desk by Wednesday. He said, well, he did this with I think most of his writers. He said, well, why don't you write it, and then you will know the length that it's supposed to be, and we'll work from there. But he was very generous with writers in terms of space.
Yeah.
And she loved that. She loved that about him. But she loved to needle him as well. He was very Victorian, almost, about things like language, and very proper. And she would put things in the book all the time.
Tell the story about the Jack, I think it was Jack Nicholson film.
Oh, yeah.
And you saw the manuscript of his edits in it.
Oh, yes. Yeah. One of the New Yorker editors was kind enough to send me some old galleys that he'd hung on to over the years. It was a Jack Nicholson picture from 1978 called Going South.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a raucous comedy with a lot of sex in it. And Pauline was giving a very, very, very vivid, earthy description of Jack Nicholson in this movie. And she said, I remember one line, I don't have it in front of me, but it was something about, he gives us that rooster who fully intends to jump the hen Lear. And Sean would, just blanched when he read this and circled it and said, oh my God, you have to put this in, you know. And she talked about how he sort of strutted around with his rump just up from the ground and everything. And you know, Sean wrote in the margins, why is she pushing her earthiness at us?
Right.
You know, which when my editor, Rick Cott, saw that when I turned in the manuscript, he called me just laughing hysterically. He said, I think that's the funniest line in the whole book. Why is she pushing her earthiness at us?
Yeah.
But she did it naturally. I mean, she was an earthy, down-to-earth person who liked a good dirty joke.
Yeah.
And loved to see, you know, sex portrayed on the screen in a real and not fakey way. But she also was doing it to get under his skin. There's no question about it.
Let me ask you about, you write about the fact that she had this kind of conflicted attitude about her Jewish past. And there's the story. I want to read. I have to do another reading here of a review she did for Fiddler on the Roof, which I think in some ways reflects that attitude. But you also tell the story about the film Shoah, which is that 9-hour documentary on the Nazi death mm-hmm. factories that she saw mm-hmm. and wrote about, and her reaction to it was quite controversial.
Yeah, it was. Needlessly controversial, I think, or not rightly controversial, I would say.
Yeah.
She did grow up in a secular Jewish household in California, but she didn't identify as Jewish in any way. It just wasn't that big a part of their lives. And she didn't even use, you know, sort of casual Yiddishisms the way lots of Gentiles do. In ordinary conversation every day. She just didn't have any connection to it. And I think it's too simple to say she was ashamed of it. I don't think she was ashamed of it at all. Mm. But she didn't like to be identified. The conflict, I think, came. She didn't like to be identified with any group, period. Mm. She was against any kind of dogma, any kind of, you know, I react this way because I'm Jewish, or I react this way because I'm Catholic, or because I'm gay, or whatever. She hated that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've all known people like this in our own lives, haven't we? You know, I have a very dear friend that I tease all the time. I said, for God's sake, for you sharpening a pencil is an act that calls into your identity as an Irish Catholic. You know, yeah. And I'm an Irish Catholic, but yeah. I don't feel that way.
And she saw that and hated it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Do you want to set up the Fiddler on the Roof excerpt? Do you think that reflects that same kind of thing?
Well, in a way, I think it does. I think that she, I mean, that's a fascinating essay, and I would urge anybody who's listening to this to read the whole review from the beginning, because she starts out with a really fascinating quote from Dorothy Parker, when Dorothy Parker was working as a screenwriter in Hollywood, and Dorothy Parker was, of course, Jewish. And this fascinating kind of look at the position of the Jewish artist in Hollywood, which is what a lot of this review has to do with. But she surprised many people by really liking Fiddler on the Roof. Yeah. She thought it was a terrific, terrific filming of the play. And she loved the heartiness of it, and she loved the sensuality that came across in it. And it was one of her more unexpected reviews of the time.
Yeah. So. And you say it demonstrated again this kind of unsentimental attitude she had toward her Jewish heritage. Here it is.
Absolutely. Yeah, she could view it with a very, very cold eye, really. You know, and she could dissect it the way she could dissect anything else. There was no sentiment there at all.
Younger members of the audience, particularly if they are Jewish, may be put off by the movie if their parents and grandparents have gone on believing in a special status with God long after the oppression was over and have tried to prop up their authority over their children with boring stories about early toil and hardship. Too many people have used their early suffering as a platitudinous weapon and so have made it all seem fake. And I suppose that Fiddler on the Roof had been such a phenomenal stage success, partly because it can be used in the same self-congratulatory way as a public certificate of past suffering.
From Pauline Kael, Brian Kello is with us. His book is called Pauline Kael, A Life in the Dark. We need to take another break. We'll take a break and then come back for some final thoughts in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Brian Kello. We're talking about his book, Pauline Kael, A Life in the Dark. So what did Pauline Kael consider a great movie star, Brian Kello? Because she had this idea that it wasn't necessary to be a brilliant actor as long as the audience was, as you put it, seduced by their presence.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, she was very, very drawn to vivid women, certainly, on the screen. We've talked about some of the earlier ones, like Stanwyck and Davis and Hepburn. She did not go, in general, for noble and long-suffering heroines.
Yeah.
Such as Greer Garson or Irene Dunn or people like this. In later years, she loved Deborah Winger, loved her, was fascinated by her, thought she was one of the greatest talents to hit the screen in a long time. And, I mean, there was a vividness and a kind of, I think, messiness about Deborah Winger that she really responded to very, very strongly. She was a great, great fan of, she loved a wide range of people, really. She loved, earlier on, she had loved Diane Cannon, I think for similar reasons, that she was kind of this messy, funny comedian.
She felt conflicted about Meryl Streep.
Very conflicted. She loved Barbara Streisand, of course.
Yeah, of course.
She was a great talent, which of course she is. And she followed her career very closely. An interesting thing about Streisand is that she knew Streisand rather well.
Yeah.
And Streisand would often show her early cuts of her films. And she would be very honest about what she thought. And Streisand would take it. She respected Pauline's opinion very much. And I think she definitely felt that at a certain point, by going for a softer screen image, Streisand had gotten off the track artistically quite badly. Although she loved Yentl. Yentl was
that's unbelievable.
Yeah, well, it's a surprise, I think.
That's what's great about her.
It's a real surprise. Yeah. You couldn't predict her.
No,
you really couldn't predict her. There was a one of my favorite reviews she ever wrote is of Alan Parker's 1981 picture Shoot the Moon, which is not remembered nearly as well as it should be. It's a fantastic movie with Diane Keaton, another star she loved, and Albert Finney. And she said, you know, in his first three films, his first two films, rather, nothing went right. In Shoot the Moon, nothing goes wrong.
Yeah.
So she was more than capable of changing her. You know, she didn't just condemn a certain director for all time. I mean, if he did good work, she was more than capable of saying so. But she loved Diane Keaton. She had tremendous conflict about, well, I don't think she had much conflict, actually. I just don't think she liked Meryl Streep.
No, no.
She said she was an actress who acted from the neck up. And I think that's a very interesting comment. I feel there's a lot of truth in that.
Can I play an excerpt?
Sure.
This is a review from Sophie's Choice, which I think expresses that. Her mm-hmm. not disdain, but
no.
She didn't think much about all the accents. And, you know, you get an accent every year with Meryl Streep. And
right.
This was earlier on anyway, Sophie's Choice. Here again from Pauline Kael.
Streep is very beautiful at times. And she does amusing, nervous bits of business, like fidgeting with a furry boa, her fingers twiddling with our heartstrings. She has, as usual, put thought and effort into her work. But something about her puzzles me after I've seen her in a movie. I can't visualize her from the neck down. Is it possible that as an actress she makes herself into a blank and then focuses all of her attention on only one thing? The toss of her head, for example, in Manhattan? Her accent here? This could explain why her movie heroines don't seem to be full characters and why there are no incidental joys to be had from watching her. It could be that in her zeal to be an honest actress, she allows nothing to escape her conception of a performance. Instead of trying to achieve freedom in front of the camera, she's predetermining what it records.
Let me ask you this finally, Brian Kello.
Yeah.
What do you think, how are you measuring Pauline Kael's influence today, now?
I think it's clear that people are still talking about her constantly.
Yeah.
They're debating her. I mean, the publication of this book and the Sanford Schwartz edited collection of her writings that came out at the same time last fall, these brought forth immense discussions online and in print about the legacy of Pauline and her lasting influence. I think she still is the most provocative and entertaining and deeply persuasive critic that ever existed. I just do. I wouldn't have spent this much time working on a book about her if I didn't think that. But the times have changed so much and the culture has changed so much, you know. You have to remember that she was writing in a, like I was saying before, in a great time of social change and social upheaval. And that was all part of it, I think. And I think she would be very... It's hard for me to second guess her, and I'm glad you didn't ask me to tell me what she would think of certain movies today, because I hate that question.
Yeah.
And everybody asks me, so thank you for not asking
me.
But I do think it's safe to say that she would be very troubled by how disengaged we are as a society now. She loved everything that was happening in the 60s and 70s. Not all of it, but a lot of it. And she thought that the movie audience was really on its way to becoming a great audience, that great audience that she wrote about in that excerpt that you read. And I think if she could look around now and see the level of disengagement that has been brought about by the technological revolution, you know, that everybody's sort of, you know, walking down the street looking at their smartphones and not paying any attention to anything else. And the general level of apathy and self-involvement that I think exists in this country to such a troubling degree right now. I mean, look at this case in Florida with this poor boy who was killed, you know, Trayvon Martin. I've mentioned this to everybody I know, and they say, well, what do you expect from Florida? Well, I expect a lot more than that. And I think it's a horrible tragedy. And I think she would be very distressed to see what's happened to that great audience. I think she'd want them to be right out there digging into everything, responding to everything, and speaking up about everything. And so I think I can safely say that.
Brian Kello, his book is called Pauline Kael, A Life in the Dark. He joined us from the studios of NPR in New York. Brian, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Ann Cullimore-Decker, who performed the readings of Pauline Kael's work for today. Technical direction from Mike Anderson, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.